communicate differing opinions to headquarters without crossing the chief. One effective method for informing headquarters of what the tech really thought involved the length of the proposal. In drafting the cable, concise and clear language signaled the tech's confidence in the operation, while a lengthy, excessively detailed proposal with pros and cons conveyed the tech's doubts and gave headquarters plenty of information to pick at and challenge. In this way, when an operation was turned down, the chief directed his displeasure at headquarters, not the tech. Interactions between the audio techs and station management mirrored family relationships more than commercial customer-supplier exchanges. This was because OTS had no competitors for the services that the stations needed, but more significantly, the case officers and techs shared a commitment to a common mission. Even so, disagreements between case officer and tech were part of the everyday picture. A regular philosophical battle was the time-on-target discussion for an operation, explained a senior audio tech. There's a school that said, when you go into a target site, stay as long as you have to and be as quiet as you can. You might be inside for 3 hours or 4 days, but take as long as you needed to do the operation silently. Another school said, you get in there, minimize the noise, but do it as fast as possible and get out in a few hours. I had one of these battles with a very tough chief of station. I lost, but he heard me out. He said, go in, don't make noise, and stay as long as you need. I took 5 solid days to get through 30 inches of concrete drilling by hand. We smelled pretty ripe, but there wasn't any question about the chain of command. When the ops people made the operational call and headquarters concurred, we saluted. Another tech disagreed with his case officer over his choice of cars for his cover status. I had a 1957 Chevy. It was a wild-looking thing, and the case officer was perturbed and thought it was too flamboyant, the tech remembered. He wanted me to get something black and spooky. I said, no, my cover is commercial, and this red Chevy with fins is expected of a successful businessman. Plus, you can see that the fins aren't as big as those on some other models. The tech's argument prevailed. An operation to bug a Czech intelligence officer in Europe almost never got to proposal stage. Headquarters rejected the station plan to send a tech on an after-hour walk around the target property to survey windows and doors, assess security, and observe activity in a neighborhood not frequented by Americans. The tech did not, headquarters pointed out, have sufficient cover and plausible reason to be in that part of the city at night. The tech and case officer agonized for a couple of days, then sent a brief cable. If caught, the tech will admit to being a thief. Then we will go to the local service and get him out of jail. Headquarters reversed itself and approved the operation. Techs, with their predilection for improvisation to get a job done, found the glamorous locales often offered the least amount of operational freedom. In Europe, it seemed you had levels and levels of agency management, all wanting to review and second-guess every piece of a plan, and there was always concern about diplomatic niceties, remembered one tech. In Africa, we shot a little more from the hip. The case officers did, too, and I think we got a lot more done. We liked working down there and in South America. In Europe, we sometimes felt smothered by a lot of tradition and scrutiny. A tech stationed in Central America during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 undertook an ambitious operation to penetrate a Soviet embassy. After learning that the Soviets used a particular shop for typewriter repair, a case officer recruited the shop's owner. The next Soviet typewriter that came in was lent to the tech, who disassembled the machine and installed a transmitter into the platen. Once back in the embassy, it was hoped the device would pick up sensitive conversations near the machine, while audio analysis of the striking keys could potentially reveal individual letters or words. Surveillance confirmed that the Soviet diplomat picked up the typewriter and took it back into the embassy. The plan was working, and after enough time elapsed for the typewriter's return to service, the tech sent a turn-on signal to the device and heard nothing. The following morning, A CIA asset observing the embassy's entrance watched a Soviet emerge carrying a typewriter high above his head. With a theatrically extravagant flourish, he heaved the offending machine into the trash. For some unknown reason, the bug had been detected and the audio operation thwarted, but wariness of the American's capability was raised to a new level. After the incident, Soviet case officers were not allowed to type their reports. All had to be handwritten. Another operation made possible by miniaturization of audio devices assisted a foreign government in catching a Soviet spy. John Kennedy was president when a Northern European security service called on TSD with an unresolved problem. A Soviet diplomat, a suspected KGB officer, had begun meeting regularly with a senior government minister. While the meetings had legitimacy based on the official duties of the two men, the security service suspected the minister of also spying for the Soviets. Yet their investigations had turned up no hard evidence of espionage. The alleged KGB officer was cagey and professional. He met the minister openly at expensive, well-known restaurants, ostensibly to discuss legitimate diplomatic matters. Several times, counterintelligence officers had notice of a planned meeting and plotted with the restaurant's manager to install monitoring equipment at the table where the Soviet would be seated, though the ploy never seemed to work. In some instances, the Soviet canceled reservations at the last moment in favor of an alternative location. In other cases, the KGB officer and minister objected to the table offered and insisted on another. Tom Grant had been in the country several times, providing technical support to joint operations. On one of his trips, Grant's contacts confided, "We're certain the minister is dirty, but we can't get the goods on the guy. We've failed every single time to record the meal conversation and haven't been able to identify the covert communications being used." Grant said he would think about the problem. Grant was living in another part of Europe with his family. One day, his wife discovered a local shop that featured Scandinavian goods, including some attractive pepper mills. "Buy every one they have in the store," he instructed his wife. "Tell the owner we have lots of friends back home who'll be getting these as Christmas gifts." None of the pepper mills ever made the trip to America. Grant went directly to the audio shop, where he had several cylindrical transmitters that would fit snugly inside the pepper mills. With the help of concealment techs, he disassembled the pepper mills and created a cavity sufficient for the transmitter, microphone, and batteries. By modifying the grinding and dispensing mechanisms, a small pepper reservoir was retained, and the mill still functioned, providing the bugs with an active concealment. When shown the pepper mill bug, the local security service agreed that it might work and sought the assistance of managers at three restaurants where the KGB officer and his minister frequently met. Rather than trying to place transmitters on a specific table, the service asked the managers to remove all pepper mills from the tables on the day of the next meeting and bring one to the table after patrons were seated. It worked like a charm. The Soviet made his reservation, then switched restaurants, but used a restaurant we had planned for, said Grant. When he arrived, he asked for a table different from the one offered. Then the minister joined him. At that point, the head waiter put our pepper mill right between the two of them. The guys in the surveillance van outside could hear everything. The suspected KGB officer and the minister ordered a meal and engaged in small talk for over an hour. At the end of the meal, they ordered coffee. The conversation had centered on official government-to-government topics, boring the counterintelligence ears in the van. However, as the business lunch finally wound down, the Russian paid the bill, then, as he took a final sip of coffee, leaned across the table, right over the pepper mill, and gave the minister precise directions for a dead drop. "Well, that woke up the ears," said Grant. The guy with the headphones in the truck went bananas. Their service was elated. Even our case officer thanked me. I said, "I'm happy to help, but you understand I have to get back my pepper mills for the agency. And besides, one of them has to go to my wife as a souvenir. She dragged me into that shop." Later, the government minister was arrested as a spy, and the KGB officer expelled from the country. In every part of the world, similar imagination and creativity were required from techs and case officers for the agency to attack the wary and protected Soviet bloc targets. An Eastern European diplomat posted to South America in the mid-1970s seemed virtually untouchable. Surveillance determined that his embassy office was well secured and his home always occupied by family, caretakers, and service staff. However, surveillance did identify an interesting pattern in his wife's regular Tuesday shopping excursions. As the case officer and the tech discussed the situation, the tech mentioned that concealment specialists had begun embedding a new generation of audio transmitters in desk and table lamps. The lamps functioned normally, the tech explained, and the transmitters operated without batteries by drawing power from the lamp's electric current. Not long after, a plan emerged. A CIA officer residing in the country began a side business selling lamps, loading his merchandise into a van every day to establish a credible pattern of activity that made him a recognized figure in the area. On the appointed Tuesday, the officer drove to the shopping district and waited for the diplomat's wife. Arriving on schedule, she parked and went into the store. A few minutes later, the officer pulled his van into the adjacent parking place, accidentally dinging the fender of her vehicle, then waited until she returned. Just as the target's wife saw the damage to her car, the lamp salesman quickly approached her, offering profuse apologies. He explained that he waited for fear that somebody might have seen the accident and taken down his license number. Then, building a tale of woe, he confessed that if he reported another accident to his insurance company, they would surely cancel his policy. Pressing far more money than required to fix the damage into the wife's hand, he implored her to accept the settlement and not report the incident. The woman, sensing a good deal, accepted the money, and in a final gesture of gratitude, the lamp salesman urged her to select any lamp from the stock in his van. The diplomat's wife chose what appeared to be the most expensive lamp, and the officer carefully loaded the gift in her car, making sure to activate the audio on switch. Later that night, the tech and the case officer met at the listening post and with amusement heard the diplomat's wife relate the story of how she had screwed over this poor American. The audio stayed on the air for about 2 months until the couple decided they liked the lamp so much that it should grace their second residence in the mountains, far out of the transmitter's range. In another operation, two techs disguised themselves as local painters to gain entry to a diplomatic facility being readied for new occupants. Their job was to find places to install bugs. As the techs studied areas where audio might be best installed, their attention fell on two large, ornately carved wooden doors piled among other materials. The doors, the techs learned, would eventually hang between two of the mission's conference rooms. The techs reasoned that by placing mics on either side of the doors, a single transmitter could pick up and relay conversations from both rooms. As an added operational bonus, the huge doors could accommodate dozens of batteries, extending the life of the operation far into the future. The techs had only a few days to work, and the presence of construction crews limited their access to the facility. The techs needed to get the doors to their shop to plant the devices. Noticing the entire construction site was a mess, with scraps of wood, fixtures, cement blocks, flooring, and other debris laying around, one of the techs said, "Let's clean this place up. They'll be happy that we got rid of the trash." The techs went to work, piling whatever construction trash they could find on the doors and carried them out like stretchers. Several stretcher loads went out, and other materials were carried in. Eventually, the doors went into the tech's waiting truck and returned a couple of days later, loaded with mics, batteries, and transmitters. "Everything just went fine," remembered one of the trash haulers. "We got the audio in, and no one ever suspected a thing." However, sound plans did not always go smoothly, and some were just victims of bad luck, falling into the category of technical success, operational failure. In one memorable instance, the Soviet ambassador in a European capital ordered a custom table for his home. The CIA got wind of the order and recruited the furniture maker, who agreed that the techs could put an audio device in the piece. The operation had every earmark of success, as the techs, observing from a safe house, watched the table as it was carefully carried up the steps to the ambassador's residence. The tech and the case officer exchanged smiles and shook hands, but before they could pour the victory toast, the delivery men appeared again. This time they carried the table out of the residence, back down the steps, and into the truck. Later that evening, as the two looked over the returned table with the furniture maker, they learned the rest of the story. The delivery men reported that when the Soviet ambassador saw the table, he was surprised to see the top was made of formica. He uttered two words, "not cultured," refused delivery, and ordered the table out of his house. At about the same time, the agency learned of another Soviet official, a newcomer to the city, who lived in an apartment hotel complex. The local station tracked the Soviets' pattern of movements for a few weeks. Then the chief decided to bug the official's residence using a recently developed audio transmitter concealed in a standard three-way electrical plug. When the modified plug was inserted into a wall outlet, it drew power from the household circuit. A week passed, and headquarters had not responded to the operational proposal. The station chief became anxious. He had an OTS technical team in the city ready to act. A detailed ops plan had been laid out. Choreographed in concert with the target's comings and goings, the installation opportunity window fell on a specific date and time, but approvals were not in hand. "If we don't hear by 8 o'clock tonight, we're going to go ahead and do this," the chief told the senior tech. The plan left little margin for error. A team of two techs would enter the apartment hotel complex. One would take temporary control of the elevator, holding it at the floor of the Soviet's apartment, and act as outside counter-surveillance. The other tech would make entry with a duplicate key and insert the modified three-way plug in an outlet under the bed. He would then exit, lock the apartment, join his colleague in the elevator, and depart the building. The entire operation would require no more than 5 minutes. At 8 o'clock, without a headquarters response, the operation commenced. The techs were well into the job when, at 8:15, the communications officer brought a cable marked "immediate" to the chief. The message, although apologetic about the delayed response, left no ambiguity. "Proposed operation is not approved." As the techs departed the Soviet's apartment complex, they received a signal to contact the chief immediately. He related the headquarters' disapproval direction. "Well, it's too late," replied the senior tech. "In fact, we're already listening to him. He came back home just behind us. He brushed his teeth and went to bed." The next morning, the device captured the personal routine of the Soviet as he prepared for the day, then went off the air at noon. The station chief was in a quandary. He had acknowledged receipt of the headquarters order, but had not told his superiors what had already occurred. He was applying the operational maxim, "What happens in the field stays in the field." The chief ordered the techs to go back to the apartment and retrieve the plug. A second entry, this one without headquarters knowledge or approval, was planned and executed. The tech crawled under the bed, but there was no plug in the outlet. He quickly surveyed other electrical outlets in the apartment, but saw no plugs. For the chief, as well as for the techs, the situation was about as bad as it could get. Not only had they conducted two unauthorized entry operations, but a piece of the CIA's newest clandestine audio equipment and its concealment were lost, very likely compromised to the Soviets. The next day, the techs met at the listening post with the Russian-language transcriber sent to TDY from headquarters to translate and process the audio tech. He had set up the post in a small room in the same building as the target apartment. The post would now have to be quietly closed down, and the transcriber sent home. As the tech related the saga of the lost transmitter and the pickle the chief found himself in, he noticed that one of the post's tape recorders was connected to building power by a familiar-looking three-way plug. "Where did you get that plug?" the tech asked. "I asked the maid for one, and she got it," the transcriber responded, a little puzzled. The maid who serviced the listening post apartment also cleaned the Soviet's room. A couple of days earlier, she had pulled the bed away from the wall to vacuum and saw the three-way plug. Concluding it was not being used, she put it in her pocket. Later, when the post's keeper asked for a plug for his tape recorders, receiver, and other equipment, she just happened to have one handy. The tech's next call went to the chief, who suggested that everyone meet for a 3-hour, 3-martini lunch. As the first round of drink arrived, the chief offered a toast. "Remember, ask and ye shall receive, seek and you shall find. Look it up, Matthew 7:7. A legendary audio semi-success occurred when a South American dictator discovered a transmitter in a wood block attached to a piece of furniture in his office. Those in the listening post recorded the dictator's outrage. Then, in dramatic fashion, he drew his pistol and fired several rounds into the device while denouncing the CIA and America to his staff. Satisfied his marksmanship had killed the device, he tossed the bullet-riddled trophy carelessly on top of a file cabinet. Back at the post, the recorders continued to roll while the device kept transmitting. The bullets had shattered the block and struck a battery, but only wounded, not killed the device. Within the heart of the woodblock, enough power still flowed to the undamaged transmitter that every word uttered in the office was heard for several more weeks, until the remaining batteries eventually died. Retrieving bugs could be as hazardous as installing them, and just as critical to an operation's success. Spy gear abandoned in place poses the risk of later detection by the local service, or, depending on future occupants, by another foreign government. Any piece of equipment discovered, even years after the operation, could reveal technology and tradecraft to the opposition. It is one of espionage's ironies that the very equipment used to acquire intelligence, once discovered by an adversary, becomes a valuable source of intelligence. Surveillance gear in the hands of a hostile security service could yield vital information for creating countermeasures, point to an agent, or expose concealment methods. Lady Luck did not smile on a retrieval operation in Western Europe in the late 1970s. A long-running successful audio operation concluded when the targets moved out of their residence and the techs received orders to return to the now empty apartment and retrieve the 4 bugs installed in the attic. It was a typical nighttime operation that demanded stealth and sure-footedness for the techs to make their way across the building's narrow rafters. The summer night was hot, and the attic increasingly uncomfortable for the techs, who, after finding the first 3 devices, were having difficulty locating the 4th. "My partner was swearing like crazy, and I'm tiptoeing across these little rafters looking for the 4th, when one of the rafters breaks," said one of the techs, remembering the incident. "The next thing I know, I'm hanging by one arm, looking down at a very expensive terrazzo floor." With the crash echoing in the middle of the night and the dust settling, the tech's radio came to life. The lookout had heard the noise and anxiously asked what was happening in the house. I said, "As you can probably surmise, we've got a little problem in here. That was me going through the ceiling." Then the 4th audio bug fell to the floor. Rather than retrace their steps over the now suspect rafters, the 2 techs dropped down through the hole. Fortunately, since the apartment had been vacated, they had time to clean up the mess and repair the ceiling. "Afterward, we just told everybody we had set the Guinness record for the world's biggest pinhole," the tech joked years later. "A 6-foot by 6-foot pinhole will give you the best audio you ever heard." God, that made a lot of noise. I can't believe we didn't get caught. A dramatic breakthrough in audio hardware occurred in the 1970s. The SRT family of transmitters, which was steadily improving, made an impressive leap forward with the Century series that carried 3 number designators. Nothing like it had previously existed in the OTS arsenal of covert audio equipment. Known particularly for the tiny size as well as performance, the Century series devices were microphones and transmitters made with integrated circuits jammed into packages of less than a cubic inch of space. OTS called it fractional cubic inch technology. To achieve the fractional cubic inch volumetric size, the whole package contained integrated circuits, very special integrated circuits, said Kurt Beck, who worked on the project. Our contractors used custom technology and processes. There wasn't anything like it on the commercial market. It was a team effort. It was the contractor and the ops guys both asking, how do you get this stuff to be this small? How do you engineer the device into the size of this package? The volume of the new audio packages was comparable to that of 6 U.S. quarters stacked one on top of another. The housing around the bug's hermetically sealed components had slots on the side that allowed techs to plug in an external power source, antenna, and microphone as needed. In less than 20 years, OTS had gone from an unreliable vacuum tube SRT-1 to a stable but power-hungry SRT-3 to a family of transmitters whose reliability, size, and functionality could be adapted to virtually any covert audio requirement. This was not your incremental, tiny improvement. This was a quantum step, said Lynn, who built power cells for the Century Series transmitters. In terms of reliability and sophistication, it was the difference between a 1970s Citizen Band radio and a 21st century cell phone. The James Bond gadgetry imagined in Q's fictional laboratory had arrived in Langley. Fractional cubic inch technology brought not only the ability to build audio into smaller concealments, but also a major reduction in power required to transmit. It allowed for simultaneous transmission from two or more microphones positioned within 3 feet of each other. Essentially working like human ears, the listening post could steer audio, filtering out background noise in the room to focus in on conversations that were of particular interest. It wasn't just the electronics, but the power consumption. The power consumption was always the problem that would knock you in the head, explained Kurt. So if we could achieve an order of magnitude reduction in the power consumption, we could make a corresponding reduction in the size of the battery. That, to me, is the breakthrough. The low-power technology. Every 10% savings in power drain translated into a big lifetime improvement for the size of the battery. It didn't make much difference if you halved the size of the transmitter from a half a cubic inch to a fractional cubic inch if the battery pack had to stay at 10 cubic inches. When OTS first envisioned the fractional cubic inch package, integrated circuits were in their infancy. A little more than a decade earlier, in 1958, Jack Kilby, working at Texas Instruments, and Robert Noyce at Fairchild Semiconductor independently came up with the idea of the integrated circuit. Kilby beat Noyce to the patent by less than a year and later won the Nobel Prize. But Noyce, who later co-founded Intel, came up with several technical solutions, such as how to connect the tiny components on the chip, which made production practical. We talked to these designers and the engineers, and we found out there were a lot of trade-offs you could make in all this stuff, Kurt explained. When we started to push on them to get the power down, ideas began to crop up. The problem was getting these analog circuits to be efficient with the power supplied. Instead of having 2% efficiency, could we get 25% efficiency? It makes a difference with the amount of power you need to run them. We pushed smaller and smaller. Our approach was to find the right designers. Give them some leeway. Don't stand over their shoulder. We gave them money and said, go try it. If you have failure, do it again. Just don't give up. In the end, the circuits designed for the new Century Series were both small and energy efficient. Tex called them flea-powered. The units drew only microamps from the batteries, and signals were transmitted at the lowest possible power setting for reception by specialized antennas at the listening posts. There was almost no end to where the new devices could be hidden. Combined with new battery configurations, the Century Series could be hidden in books, wooden coat hangers, and even within the circuitry of other electronic devices, such as televisions or portable radios. Woodblocks, a long-time favorite among techs, could be made smaller as well. Armed with new technology, techs, along with the staff at Langley, became more emboldened. Operations that would have been at best risky or impossible in the 1960s were now launched regularly. "Show me a target, and I can get to it," one tech was noted for saying. Within the tech culture, this was more statement of fact than bravado.